You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. John Whitehead is a Charlottesville-based attorney and author who has written, debated, and practiced widely in the area of constitutional law. A prominent leader in the national dialogue on civil liberties and human rights, and a formidable champion of the Constitution, Whitehead's concern for the persecuted and oppressed led him in 1982 to establish the Rutherford Institute, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the defense of civil liberties and human rights. Mr. Whitehead spoke at the January 8, 2014 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Charles Smith. Our podcast is entitled Life in the Emerging American Police State. Here's Charles Smith.
This is a book that's written by John Whitehead, and it's called A Government of Wolves. And as you can see, the subtitle says The Emerging American Police State. And they're available. This is available at Barnes & Noble. I think there will be, are you going to have a book signing here today? Yeah. There will be a book signing afterwards of those who have already purchased their copies. But what I want to do is tell you a little bit about John Whitehead. He was born in Tennessee. And that was a team that beat Virginia a couple of weeks ago. But I think you root for Virginia now, do you not? Good. And he's here with his wife, Nisha. And he's also received his law degrees, including jurisprudence. In other words, the advanced doctor of jurisprudence from University of Arkansas Law School. And he founded the Rutherford Institute here in Charlottesville in 1982. It's a Charlottesville nonprofit organization that's dedicated to the defense of civil liberties and human rights. It offers free legal services to those who had their rights violated or threatened, and has a network of affiliate attorneys across the United States, funding its efforts through donations. The Institute was named after Samuel Rutherford, a 17th century theologian who wrote a book, Rex Lex, I think it was, challenging the concept of the divine right of kings. Since that time, the aims of the Institute have expanded from defending the religious liberties of Christians to include defending the religious liberties of all Americans, you, me, everyone, as well as working to preserve rights such as free speech and the right to be secure from unreasonable search and seizure. Our speaker has written a large number of books, participated in numerous television programs, written articles for various cable news programs, and a vast number of newspapers, including our own local Daily Progress. Today's talk will explore the ways in which our freedoms and privacy rights have been eroded, as he documents in this book that we just explained to you. So we'd like to say, Mr. Whitehead, can you come tell us a little bit about what's in store with us regarding our freedoms?
Thank you very much for having me speak here today. In fact, some gentleman gave me a nice little button just a few minutes ago. He's sitting right over there. Ignore your rights, and they'll go away. So I'm wearing this proudly. And maybe he has some more, and if he wants to pass them out or sell them, which I'd buy one right away. Also at the back table is our Do You Know the Bill of Rights? These are billfold cards, which has the first 10 amendments in them. And the thing that astounds me most as a constitutional lawyer is how little Americans know about the Bill of Rights. I've had an intern program for 30 years where law students come study with me. For the last 20 years, I've been asking the students as I interview them when they study, these are law students, I ask them if they can give me the five freedoms in the First Amendment. I've not found one who can. A couple years ago, I spoke to the Bar Association here, 150 of the best lawyers in town, on our cases. In the middle of my speech, I stopped and said, I want to find out what these people know. So I said, held my card up. I said, how many people in this room can give me the five freedoms in the First Amendment? They debated. My wife, Nisha, was there. One guy raised his hand. I started pointing and he put his hand down. Not one stood up and gave me the freedoms of the First Amendment. These are lawyers. So there's a grave gap in knowledge. The schools are not teaching this. What I encourage parents to do, take this into your home, your grandchildren. I mean, I've been on radio interviews in faraway states. I was on a radio interview in the state of Washington not too long ago. A guy calls in. He didn't ask me a question. He says, thanks for your Bill of Rights card. My kids are learning their rights in the home. So you can do it. Like I say, again, ignore your rights. They'll go away. So today I want to talk to you about my experience, what I've seen in the last 40 years as a constitutional lawyer. The name of my book is The Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. It comes from a quote from Edward R. Murrow, and I'm sure many people remember Edward R. Murrow. He said, a nation of sheep begets a government of wolves. I'm seeing that happen today. Unfortunately, I think you may be the last generation, or we're going to be the last generation, if we don't act and get some of our young people involved. They'll not know freedom as we have known it, unfortunately, and I'm going to go into some of the ways I see that happening. I basically see three different camps on how people view the Constitution and their rights. The first camp is the camp that says, I trust government implicitly, I have faith in the government, they'll always do the right thing. The second camp is those who don't trust the government to do anything. They believe the government's out to get them. And then there's the third camp, which says the government's neither an angel nor a devil, but something that needs to be controlled. In my opinion, of course, that's the view of our founding fathers. In my book, if those of you get a chance to read it, I go through science fiction films. I've written on films for years. The thing that kind of blew my mind when I was working on this book, A Government of Wolves, was how movies I was watching over the years, people I were reading like George Orwell, Aldous Huxley, Philip K. Dick, people like that. I went back and read some books before I wrote the book, and I was astounded how much they had predicted the future. In fact, the movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise, how many people have seen that film? If you haven't, I'm encouraging people to look at it. That movie is set in 2054, 40-some years from now, or 40 years from now. Every bit of technology in that film that was predicted to be available in 50 years when that movie was made is available now to the United States government. Very intrusive stuff. So what a lot of people prophesied, Huxley, Orwell, you go down the line, is occurring, in our, unfortunately, today. I use the word police state. When I use the word police state, I'm not talking about local police. That's just part of it. When I use the word police state, I'm talking about all levels of government agencies from the FBI, the IRS, the National Security Agency, the Department of Homeland Security, and the local police. They work in conjunction now. A few of the cases that we're actually handling, you'll see that, how they work in conjunction. So when I use the word police state, I'm not talking about primarily local police. In fact, I will say this. I'm working with a lot of local police across the country right now. They actually come and visit me. A number of them have read my new book, and they agree with it. A lot of the older policemen are very concerned about what they're seeing, especially militarized police, which is a subject that we hear more and more about these days with all the SWAT team raids that are going on. There are about 70,000 SWAT team raids that are occurring across the United States annually, and that is increasing. In fact, I've been told by people in the Secret Service that it's actually more than that. And all levels of government have SWAT teams, by the way. The IRS, the Department of Fisheries, the Department of Education has SWAT teams. The Department of Education, as I show in my book, has actually been doing SWAT teams where they crash through people's doors, pull them out on the lawns, push them face down for drug dealing? No. Storing up arms and ammo? No. Oh, yeah. Overdue loans. Overdue loans. You got to be kidding me. Those are the kind of things we're seeing. In the 1980s, the Pentagon started handing out millions upon millions of dollars worth of equipment to local police agencies across the country. That's where basically the origin of SWAT teams. You're talking about assault vehicles, grenade launchers, MRAPs. How many people know what MRAPs are? MRAPs are these large vehicles that have small turrets. Culpeper, they just had a show of the Culpeper police standing by an MRAP. Towns that have 5,000 people now have MRAPs, or assault vehicles, and assault uniforms, Kevlar helmets, assault rifles. to the point that, again, and this program has picked up steam over the years. It actually slowed down during George W. Bush's administration, but during Barack Obama's administration, it has zoomed. So what you have is local police agencies now that look like the military and often act like the military. In one chapter in my book called The Psychology of Compliance, I show how psychologists have studied and they, why do, for example, 75 to 80% of SWAT teams, SWAT team raids, are conducted for mere warrant service these days, not for so-called dangerous, super dangerous criminals or anything like that, where they're going through people's doors. People and the psychologists looked at it and they studied it, and what they came up with was once, and American soldiers have actually said this, some that I defend, by the way, veterans, once you put that military uniform on and get in a group and you're doing this and you're local police, like you're the military, you act like the military. And so what does the American citizen look like? The enemy. But what does our Constitution say? We are the masters. The police are not the masters. The president's not the masters. The local mayor's not the master. We're the masters. What I've seen over the last, especially 20 years, is this idea that somehow now we're the servants and somehow the government's the masters, as we'll see in all the things I'm going to tell you in just a minute. The SWAT team raids are one dangerous area that we have to be very careful about. In fact, the Supreme Court has actually held this in a case called Kentucky versus King. If a SWAT team is going after somebody and they actually end up at the wrong door, okay, and they think you might be doing something, they might hear something inside, a movement or something, or smell something, they can actually go through your door without a warrant. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the only judge that dissented in that case, the Supreme Court, said this. She said it's the end of the Fourth Amendment. How many people actually know what the Fourth Amendment says in this room? The Fourth Amendment says this: you cannot touch an American citizen, you cannot do surveillance on an American citizen unless you have probable cause. What does probable cause mean? Well, there must be some evidence, some reasonable suspicion. That's what the police say now, but it doesn't. Reasonable suspicion is not the constitutional standard. Some evidence, even minor evidence, that something illegal is going on. So, to me, the bedrock of the Constitution is the Fourth Amendment. I talk to people from both sides of the political aisle, left-wing, right-wing, libertarians, who say the Fourth Amendment is dead. In fact, one of my best friends is a fellow named Matt Henhoff, who is a legend, but he's called me and said, John, it's on life support. I talked to him not too long ago, and he said, John, they pulled the plug on the Fourth Amendment. So that's what we're facing. To give you some ideas of how bad, a couple years ago, a Marine named Jose Guerrera, decorated Marine, was asleep in his home in Arizona. The police were doing a sweep of the neighborhood trying to find people with marijuana. And this is the way they do it. They do it in the middle of the night, 3 a.m., bam, boom, the house lights up. Loud noises, they throw flashbang grenades, because they do it in the middle of the night because you're disoriented, you're asleep. Well, Jose, being a Marine, jumps up, a big guy, grabs his wife and kids and puts them in a closet and stands at the end of his hallway with his only rifle he has, a hunting rifle. The police enter, 10. They see this man standing in another hallway with his rifle. They open fire, 70 rounds. 50 rounds struck Jose. He falls to the ground. He's still breathing. His wife screaming, let the medics help him. They wouldn't let the medics near him. He bled to death. His blood's goozing out of his mouth on his own floor. The police said he had fired at him. An investigation showed that Jose's gun, the safety had never come off. Then there's the case of Ayanna Jones in Detroit, again a couple years ago. This 10-year-old girl is asleep in her Detroit apartment, her princess blanket wrapped around her, sleeping on her princess pillow. The police do a SWAT team raid on the apartment. They're looking for some guy, supposedly, in that apartment. They come through the door, smash it down, and actually through the windows in this case. 3 a.m. in the morning, one of the guns goes off, striking Ayanna Jones, blowing her chest off. She falls off on the floor, blood splatters on the floor. Her father runs out of the bedroom screaming, sees his daughter bleeding to death, and says, "Why have you killed my daughter?" They push him face down in the floor. And you know what? They were in the wrong apartment. They didn't have the search warrant. The guy they needed was two floors up. You know what? They got him finally. But Ayanna Jones had to die for that to happen. So those are the kind of cases I'm seeing on a routine basis. If you have dogs, by the way, how many are dog lovers in here? They shoot them first, poodles, chihuahuas, they execute them on sight. You can go on YouTube and see some of these raids. They're pretty scary. There's one I watched not too long ago where a fellow, they did a raid and he just shot his dogs. And the only thing he could say as they slammed him against the wall is, "Why'd you kill my dog?" And he's crying. So there is a mentality that has surrounded these SWAT teams. They're very military, and like I say, I've had local policemen here, by the way, some good men come to me, and they've read the book, and they say, "We agree. What do we do about this?" And so I'm actually meeting with some law enforcement people over the next couple months, and we're going to try to figure out some way to make sure this kind of stuff does not happen very often here in Albemarle County. But those are the kind of things we're seeing happening. The other thing that the Fourth Amendment stands for is bodily integrity, and that is, government agents are not supposed to touch you or in any way unless, again, they have probable cause. Well, I don't know if you kept up with some of the big cities across the country where they're doing strip searches on the street while 50 people watch. One of the most egregious thing is, like in Milwaukee, they've been doing anal rectum searches on men on the street causing bleeding. In Oakland, the same thing. The police have been sued in Oakland. Then there's the outrageous cases such as Ashley Dobbs and her niece were driving through Texas about this time last year, about August, I think. And a policeman pulled them over and said, "Did you throw a cigarette out of the car?" And she says, "No, I don't think so." He says, "Do you have marijuana in the car?" That was the first thing he asked Ashley Dobbs. Her niece is sitting there. And she says, "No." Well, that wasn't enough for the policeman. He pulls Ashley Dobbs out of the car. He leads her back, calls another policeman. They did vaginal and rectum searches on her, finding no marijuana, by the way, without changing the gloves, by the way. And she sued for $1.5 million. And folks, I hope she wins. There's the case of Layla Tarantino just recently in a routine traffic stop. The police pulled her over, and for some reason they asked her to step out of the car, and she did. They did two strip searches while her children were watching in the car. And while passerbyers are going by, and one cop actually reached up and pulled a tampon out of her vagina. I hope she's going to file a lawsuit. So those are the kind of cases we're seeing. A lot of this is coming from the so-called war on drugs. When police do SWAT team raids on marijuana, they get federal grants for it. They actually get paid. So what we're finding, and this is, I'm not the one saying this, a lot of people have researched this, saying there's a financial motive to a lot of these things. And like I said, 75 to 80% of these SWAT team raids, which I say are very, very egregious and dangerous, are carried out for mere warrant service. I don't know if you remember when I was a child, it took a single policeman in a brown uniform, not a black uniform, with a Kevlar helmet, who would come to your door and actually present a warrant. The warrant procedure is very, very important, by the way. The founding fathers were against general warrants, which was what the British would do, they would just issue a general warrant and search everybody in town. But what the founding fathers wanted was, again, specific evidence you're doing something wrong. And if it's not exigent circumstances, you go to a judge, you present your case, and he decides whether or not to give you a warrant. And even then, if you're not a dangerous criminal, and they know that, okay? If you're not a dangerous criminal and they know that, they should arrive at the door and say, "Are you Mr. Whitehead? Are you Mr. Jones?" Because what we're finding in a lot of some of these crazy SWAT team raids is they're winding up at the wrong door at the wrong time, and people are getting hurt and people are getting killed. We actually have a case in Texas, a guy named John Quinn. The police had some evidence that he was living with his son, that his son had some drugs. The police actually got a warrant, but they did not have a no-knock warrant. They did a background search, found out that the father had a hunting rifle. So they decided to do a middle-of-the-night SWAT team raid just because he had a legally owned shotgun. They go through the door, smash it down into the apartment. The father's asleep in the bed. The son's in another room. They invade the father's room first. The father sets up and reaches for his glasses, and they shoot him in his bed. Didn't kill him. And we have a case in the Court of Appeals in Texas on that issue. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm seeing and the kind of stuff that really, really bothers me, not only as a citizen, but as a lawyer. We cannot transgress the Fourth Amendment. If the Fourth Amendment is done away with, and you have these little things, read it. Read the Fourth Amendment. If you do away with the Fourth Amendment, as I tell people say to me, well, isn't the First Amendment the most important thing, the right to free speech? I say, well, the right to free speech doesn't mean anything if you're sitting in the back of a car with handcuffs behind you in a police car. It means nothing. So the key is the Fourth Amendment, and that's what I see, unfortunately, disappearing today. Another thing that I'm seeing, and which troubles me, and this is a case that we're currently litigating in the courts, and some of you may know about this case. Again, when I say the word police state, I'm not talking about local police. I'm talking about all government agents. August 2012, Brandon Robb, decorated Marine, Afghanistan, Iraq, had a home business. He had just got through jogging. He didn't have his shirt on. He has jogging shorts on. He was at his typewriter working at his home business. He hears a noise outside, loud noises, cars pulling up. He walks up to the window and looks out there, and there's black vehicles driving in front of his house in his driveway, and out jumps the guys in the black outfits and guys in plain clothes, black clothes, running up toward his house. Well, he opens the door and says, "What's up?" And they said, "Would you step out, Mr. Robb?" They knew who he was. And so, being the police, all this, he first asked, "Why are you here?" And they said, "Well, it's your Facebook post." Well, Brandon Robb is, again, a Marine. He's an intelligent guy. He had some problems with President Obama's executive orders. He had voiced concern over that and the way the government was going. Basically, First Amendment kind of stuff. Remember, we have a First Amendment right to protest, present our grievances. He was doing that on his Facebook post. He was playing a private Facebook game, which I don't do any of that only his brother and sister could get in, called Mr. Illuminati. It was a game. That concerned the agents. Well, he asked who they were first, and what they, local police, Department of Homeland Security, FBI, other Secret Service agents. He steps out. They immediately grab him, handcuff him behind his back, without even giving his Miranda warnings. They lead him out to a car. He doesn't have his shirt on. He says, "Can I please have a shirt?" And one of the policemen was upset by Brandon's arguing with him. He slammed Brandon against the fence, lacerating his back about 6 or 7 inches. It started bleeding badly. He gets to the police station. He asks for a shirt. I mean, for a bandage. They stick a prison shirt on him. It sticks up in the cut so that when he moves, it cracks and it hurts. They put him in a jail cell. We called the police, and I asked, "What has this man been charged?" His mother was freaking out. She went on the internet trying to find somebody to help. Finally, we responded. I said, "Yeah, sure, we'll look into this." I asked the police chief what he had done. He said, "Oh, he's committed no crime. We're concerned about his Facebook posts. That's what we're concerned about." He had a 2-minute investigation in a jail cell by a psychiatrist who said that Brandon's long pauses in answering made him think that he may be mentally ill. Now, let me ask you a question. If you take basic civics, do you answer questions from a government agent without your lawyer present? No. Brandon knows that. He's an intelligent guy. He had a short hearing. He was put in a mental hospital, moved 3 hours away from us, his lawyers, and his family in Roanoke. We filed a lawsuit, moved into court. A good judge, by the way, looked at the facts and said, "There's no reason to have this man in a mental institution. This is crazy. The government's crazy." He let him out. We've sued the federal government over that issue. We're in court on a civil rights case on that particular issue. Believe it or not, there are 20,000 plus of these civil commitments in Virginia each year alone. There are 1.5 million of them across the United States annually. Recently, I was alerted by some civil rights groups that in Florida alone, they've increased by 80% civil commitments. In many of these cases, of course, people, there's concern about them. But in many of the cases, people just kind of go away and you'd never hear of them. If we hadn't gotten involved in the Brandon Robb case, and he knows this, and his family, they're very grateful, he'd still be there. He'd still be there. So we're seeing that model. I actually had an NSA agent visit me about 6 months ago. He had read my book. He liked it. This is he'd been an NSA agent for over 20 years. He doesn't like what the National Security Agency is doing. He said, John, we're following the Soviet model. I had no idea what he was talking about. He said, in the Soviet Union, the way they handled dissidents and people who disagreed was mental institutions. Remember Andrei Sakharov? How many of you remember all that? They put them in mental institutions, and they just kind of disappeared, and people just assumed they were all crazy. And so I didn't, you know, maybe we are, maybe we're not. But, you know, again, this is what an NSA agent told me. Another thing that bothers me, and I'll just be really careful, is government paranoia. I don't know if you know this, but a little over a year ago, the Department of Homeland Security actually contracted. They didn't buy them up from the market. They contracted to buy over 1 billion hollow point bullets for their use by their agents and other federal agents, such as IRS SWAT teams. The Department of Fishery has. The Department of Fishery has hollow point bullets to shoot fish, protect deer against hunters. I mean, all these, the Department of Education has hollow point bullets. I don't know, I was an infantry officer. We weren't allowed to use hollow point bullets because on impact, they make a small hole. On exit, they blow you apart. If a hollow point bullet hits you in the arm, you go down, you're dead. Now, why in the world does, and there's been no explanation of this, a lot of people think it's the veterans. There's a lot of veterans groups. In fact, I'm meeting with some veterans in February on this issue. Veterans groups are calling us from, have called us around the country. When they do Facebook posts now, they're critical of the government. If they're critical of the government, if they're away from home, they'll come home. There's a little bitty tag around the door saying the FBI wants an interview. The FBI arrives and says, we want to interview you over your Facebook post. These are intimidation tactics, by the way. We've actually helped in some of those cases and pushed the FBI back. They really can't intimidate you because you're expressing concerns about how the government's going. We actually had, and this is a true story, and this is a chilling story. There's a very fine veteran in Virginia who does unbelievable stuff for veterans. He's concerned that veterans don't get the kind of help they need. He goes to the hospitals, he takes some goods, he takes some medical supplies. He tries to get make sure that veterans are taken care of by the veterans of the hospital. We get a lot of complaints, by the way, from veterans and veterans' families they're not getting taken care of. My wife, Nisha, sent him an email. At night, our house was shaking, basically. These large airplanes were flying over our home. So she sent an email and said, what do you think's up? And he emailed back and said, he's a former Secret Service agent, by the way, and veteran. He just emailed back and says, they're doing training exercises north of Charlottesville because Charlottesville, I think, is similar. I think the country was Pakistan, was it, Nish? I like that. Whatever. And they're simulating exercises. And that's all he said. Well, about a week later, I get a phone call. And he says, I got to talk to you, John. So he comes into my office, closes the door, and starts crying. I said, what's up, dude? He said, two NSA agents just visited me yesterday. They said if I emailed you again, they were going to deport me. He said they had their guns, and they were very, very explicit about what they were saying. I either shut up or they're going to take me outside the country. This is an outstanding man. Those are the kind of things we're seeing happening, which are frightening. The National Security Agency. All we do is research these things. The National Security Agency, in conjunction with the FBI, the CIA, and other agencies, Department of Homeland Security, which is a ringleader in this area, if you do any electronic banking, how many people in this room do electronic banking, Visa cards, debit cards? Well, the government knows everything that's in your bank account. If you do text messages, they're all downloaded. I had one NSA agent tell me, a longtime veteran, that they're doing at least a trillion, this is what his figure, a trillion a month, emails of American citizens, by the way. You're not talking about Al-Qaeda. The FBI admits now that they've actually downloading our phone calls. Again, let's go back. What does that Fourth Amendment say? You're not supposed to be peeping into my records or my phone calls or my emails or my Facebook posts without probable cause. So they're collecting it willy-nilly. And I get people who ask me, well, if I'm not doing anything wrong, what the heck? Well, if you make a mistake, for example, on your tax return or in a bank account, you're going to get audited, folks. The IRS is already doing that, and that's very intimidating. We forget that if you're a troublemaker out there, and some people think I'm a troublemaker, but I'm really not, I won't say a nice guy, I go home and just relax. Not really, I'm a troublemaker. If you're a troublemaker, like Martin Luther King, for example, the FBI collected 17,000 pages of information on Martin Luther King to discredit him. This is all documented in my book, all footnoted. One FBI agent actually sent King a letter and said he should commit suicide, or they were going to release the information about him to the public. Thank God the man kept going. But what was Martin Luther King doing wrong? Was he doing something wrong, folks, you think, fighting for equality for all Americans? For some reason, he was considered a threat by the FBI. So, if you're out there and active, or let's say you do something they don't like, or you do something they think is weird, they're looking into you. We all have a file in this room. If you use a cell phone, you have a file, folks. We know that now. The government admits that. And there's nothing, in my opinion, we can do to contain most of that. I don't know if you know this, but the NSA, which I've been writing on since the 1980s, has a program called Echelon. How many people know about Echelon? Echelon is a program, they have worldwide bases in New Zealand, Great Britain, Australia, where they have created what I call a global concentration camp, in essence, where anything you do around the world, they collect. They collect it on other governments. We know the German government's upset now. The French are upset. The Brazilians are upset because they found out the NSA is collecting information on everybody. What kind of government does that? It's a secret government. What do we know about secret governments in the past? They're not very, very friendly, folks, generally, especially if you get someone in there who has the wrong motives. Let us not forget what the Founding Fathers taught us. James Madison said, we ought to mistrust all those in power. Not hate them, dislike them. We ought to distrust them. Why? Because, as we know, people in power do abuse that power. And the most precious thing we have is our civil liberties and freedoms to operate supposedly in a democratic society. But if you have people out to get you or looking for you or trying to find you're making a mistake or waiting for you to take a stand on freedom to go down to the city council, maybe cause a stir. If you make a mistake, that could be used against you. Let's go back and tell you about that fellow that came into my office crying. All he did was tell the truth. He didn't give away any secrets. They told him to shut up or they were going to take him outside the country. What we're facing in the future is awesome. The city of Charlottesville, a little over a year ago, passed a resolution regulating drones. How many people remember that? I wrote it. I wrote the legislation. And basically sent articles to the city council and got 3 votes, and we got it passed. It was the first one in the world, first piece of drone legislation in the world. I had people from Germany, the German magazine Der Spiegel did a feature on me. But the French people call me, English people, but what both of them are asking are, well, how'd you do this, and are Americans crazy? Why do they want drones flying over the United States? Well, President Obama signed legislation into a law allowing drones to fly over the United States legally in 2015 without any civil liberties protections whatsoever. Not one iota. Why would we need civil liberties protections from drones? Well, if you go to our website at Rutherford.org, and I encourage you this, read my weekly commentaries, because that's what we do. We study these trends. We footnote them. Drones are cutting-edge technology. In fact, just yesterday, Boeing announced they're developing a drone bigger than any airplane they have, basically. It'll be able to sweep over an entire city and collect all your Wi-Fi information, text messages, and just suck them up. And guess who cooperates with this information? The NSA, the CIA, the Department of Homeland Security. They collect all this information. Drones also, again, cutting-edge technology. They have a Seagull drone. They're developing a prototype mosquito drone, which will be able to land on you and possibly do two things. Collect DNA from you. For some reason, they want your DNA. And two, to inject you with something. Let's say you want a free speech protest in the future. Well, that Seagull drone, that mosquito drone, that beetle drone, by the way, they have beetle drones. Those are already perfected. They can be in your home, living in your walls, listening to everything you're doing. I mean, I go back and say, what kind of mind creates these kind of things? There's the Atlas Android drone. I hope you're familiar with some of this stuff. The Atlas Android drone is a 6-foot, 330-pound robot. You can go online. I would encourage you, go online. If you can go on YouTube, you can watch the prototype. This is probably the policeman of the future. It'll be able to come to your door. I had a friend tell me, a friend in Washington who was up kind of in the hierarchy. We were talking about the Atlas Android, and he said, I just throw acid in its face, comes to my door. I said, dude, it doesn't have flesh. It's not going to respond to acid. And can you imagine arguing with an Android drone? And these things are going to be the prototype. Pretty soon you're going to see them at people's doors. Can you imagine arguing with the Atlas Android over whether or not it has a warrant? What do you say to that? If it wants to come in your home, do you go, it's 330 pounds. It can grab you by the throat and throw you away. Google, by the way, just bought their eighth robotic corporation. That's the wave of the future. They have the cheetah android now. It runs like a cheetah, a bear. All these things are coming. You may think this is preposterous, but it's not. I've actually talked to professors who are teaching drone technology now, and they say sometime after 2020, it's going to be awesome. I mean, you're going to have a seagull drone sitting out in your tree, and you won't know it looks just like a seagull. You can go on YouTube, by the way, and watch the hummingbird drone. It flies up to your window. It looks just like a hummingbird. I can't tell the difference by watching the YouTube video. It'll be able to film you. Your neighbors will have that. So what's the problem? Well, again, if they don't have a search warrant, if they don't have evidence that you're doing anything wrong, should they be able to collect that information? Also, should they be able to, if your neighbors are going to have, they're going to have drones too. I mean, Amazon, all these groups are going to use them. Sharper Image is already selling a helicopter drone. They're going to collect information against you. Let's say you have a neighbor who really doesn't like you. Should the police have access to that, collecting information? See, the question here, and psychologists look at it, if we're in sort of a human goldfish bowl and we're always being watched, how does that affect us psychologically? What did George Orwell say? You had to live like you're being watched and listened to all the time. Well, Google admits now, when your television's on sometimes, they can actually hear you moving around your home and listening to what you're saying. They announced that several years ago. Why? For marketing purposes, supposedly. But should the government be peeping in my home? I have a right to be in my home. Is my home my castle? Do you really think your home's your castle anymore? If a SWAT team without a warrant can smash through your door, if they can drive by the way, they have mobile police scanners now, like the TSA scanners in airports. They can drive by and stop in front of your home and see the outline of your body. You're moving around in your home. Drones have scanning technology as well. They can fly over your home and look down your home and see what you're doing. Let's say you're actually cleaning your legally owned shotgun and the police disagree. You get a SWAT team raid? I mean, these are all the possibilities that are presented to me by other people. These are not fantasy. These are all facts. So this is what we're facing in the future. So will anybody protect us from these things? What we're finding is the courts, I call them courts of order, generally not courts of justice. Most courts will not listen to a thing you say about these issues. Judges are very nervous and very pro-statist generally. We're finding that in cases we're involved in. I mean, Kentucky versus King, like I said, the Supreme Court ruled, if they show up the wrong door, they don't have a warrant, they can smash down your door and come in, shoot your dog, and maybe shoot you, and that's okay? There's no liability for the police when they do that? That's what they held. Well, why not be one of them if you want to be tough and override the Constitution? So those are the kind of things we're seeing across the country. I'm going to open it for question and answers in just a moment. So you, if you have questions, be formulating them in your mind. The other thing that really bothers me, and we've handled hundreds of these cases, is the criminalization of what I'm seeing of children, especially in the schools. We've handled hundreds of cases. We had a case right now in Pennsylvania, to give you an example. A young boy named Johnny Jones needed a pencil. He was 10 years old. He went up to his teacher, and the teacher said, yeah, here's your pencil. You need a pencil. He's walking back to his seat. He's a fourth grader. His friend, one of his best friends, takes his folder and goes, pow, with his lips. Secretly, he says, pow. Well, Johnny Jones takes his pencil and pretends it's a bow and arrow and shoots a imaginary arrow. Boing, teacher pulls them both out, throws them out of school. For what? What do you think they threw them out of school for? Weapons violation? Yes, under a zero tolerance policy. We actually had a case in Louisiana where a young boy, again a fourth grader, drew his uncle a stick figure who was in Afghanistan. He was proud that his uncle was over there fighting. He drew him with a stick figure gun, was so proud that he wanted to show his classmates. He took it, opened it up in the lunchroom, teacher saw it, bingo, he was tossed out of school. Why? A weapons violation. You gotta be kidding me. Where was the weapon? We defended four boys up in New Jersey, kindergartners, who were on the playground doing what I did probably in high school, going bang, bang around the gym set. Bingo, they grabbed him, called the police, pulled him into the principal's office, expelled him from school for a weapons violation. When the reporter called me, he said, wow, could this be dangerous? Dangerous? And I said, yeah. Boy, he could poke somebody in the eye like that. A weapons violation. The kid we helped, though, was really sad. A lot of these kids, when they're thrown out of school, have to undergo psychological counseling. He wanted to be a policeman. After that, he didn't want to see policemen anymore. He said, I never want to be a policeman. I don't have anything to do with any of that. And he had to go into psychological counseling. The little boy who brings a Lego soldier into school with a half-inch rifle is thrown out of school for a weapons violation. The little boy who wears his grade school kid, who wears his hat in proudly with little soldiers, you know, the little flat ones I played with as a kid, you know, they're crawling in the sand or whatever, he's removed from school for a weapons violation. And a girl we defended down in Florida, one of the best students in the school, African-American girl. She was at the back of the classroom. She had her nail clippers in her little purse. The girl across the aisle said, hey, can I borrow your nail clippers? And she said, sure. So she reaches across the aisle and gives them to her. Teacher saw it. They grab them. They see the little bitty thing you pick your nails with. It isn't even a knife. It's like a file. Serious weapons violation. Tossed out of school for a year and 3 months. We threatened lawsuit. The parents argued racial discrimination. It may have been true in that case. I don't know. And just because of the bad publicity, the school dropped it. If it hadn't been for that, we'd have had to fight that one in the courtroom. And again, those cases are tough to win in the courts. So These are what I'm seeing across the country. These are just some of the trends. I think the trends are extremely dangerous. And like I say, this may be the last generation if we don't turn these things around. And when I tell people, there are no problems. There's only solutions. So what are the solutions here? I say, act locally, think nationally. If we could pass a drone ordinance in this town that other cities now have modeled after, by the way, across the country and are continuing to think about modeling after, then anybody can. There's enough power just in this room to change this entire town if we see things we don't like. And you're going to see things you don't like. You have to stay alert. Again, another place, watch our website. We know what's going on even in Charlottesville. Stay alert. When police now in some states are pulling people over who have no alcohol or drugs in them and actually have in Louisiana forcibly drawn blood from people, something's up, folks. It only will go so far as you allow it. As I always say, when good steps back, evil steps forward. And what do I mean by evil? Evil is not treating us like we're human beings, not abiding by our Constitution. But whose fault is it? How's the Constitution began? There's three beautiful words. Anybody can tell me? There you go. We the people. The government that that Washington and Jefferson and Madison, all those people gave us, it wasn't supposed to be top down. Read carefully. What's that term that we never hear anymore and people say is dead? Federalism? It was the cities and counties that were the primary governments. Now we look to Washington, D.C. for all the answers. We have a president who lives in basically a castle. We can't see him, but every major corporation can see him. We have trouble seeing our congressman. There's at least 25 lobbyists per congressman. We can't get in the door like those guys because we don't have the dough, the money to fund their campaigns. But can we do grassroots change? Yes. Charlottesville basically pointed the way and say, yes, you can do it. I see other communities. Like I tell people, one person at a city council meeting with a sign is considered a weirdo. Three people with that sign is considered a movement. They count numbers. You can only be intimidated if you allow it. Groups getting together. I'm arguing here, and I'm meeting next month with some citizens in this town to start a civil liberties oversight board in Charlottesville. With key people who want to make, and there are some people in this town are really concerned about what's happening in Albemarle County. They want to make sure we don't turn out like some of these other places in the country. There are people who are now holding weekly phone meetings in their town saying, we got to watch this. They just did this. Let's get down to the city council meeting. Let's grab our picket sign. Martin Luther King was one man. He changed the face of the country. And how did he do it? He didn't stop. He never backed up, even when he was threatened to be killed. He, in my opinion, reading his writings, he knew he was probably going to get shot or hurt. But did he give up? When the FBI said, we're going to destroy your personal life, did he quit? No. So, the average American watches approximately 160 hours of television a month. What I'm asking Americans is, give freedom one-third of those hours. Get involved. Get up off your butts. And let's change this country. And you'll change it only one way. Let's get active. But here's the key. Education precedes action. Go to our website. Get up on these issues. I shouldn't be telling you. You should know this information. Two, put this thing in your billfold. Then take it out and teach other people this. Your friends, your neighbors. We give these things away free, $20,000 a year. You want 10 or 20 of these things, and you'll pass them out, I'll be glad to stick them in your hand, the handout, okay? So, I don't do this for money. We're not wealthy people. I haven't had a raise in 15 years. I don't do this for money. I do this for two, basically the children, coming up today, my grandchildren, I want to see them live in a country where people like me can still talk about these things. There may become a day, however, when that may not be true. And that's what I'm most fearful of. But you're the answer. I thank you for coming today. If you've got any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
On a related topic, could you talk a bit about civil forfeiture, which I find equally scary?
Okay, sure. The question concerns civil forfeiture, what I call asset forfeiture. Yeah, it's a big problem. You can go on our website. I've actually written on asset forfeiture and in many areas, including Virginia, by the way. If you're pulled over and charged with a crime, your car can be confiscated, sold, and the government gets a cut of the profit. If it's a drug-related offense, supposedly the federal government gets, 50%. So it's a money-making venture, yes. It's part of what I call the end of private property. It's something that some, Civil Liberties Oversight Board, what we're going to try to set up here, would actually confront that issue. But it is happening in Virginia. It's happened in Albemarle County. So it's a very dangerous thing. Yes, you can be found not guilty, but you have to go to court to get your property back. And guess who you have to pay? A lawyer. So it'd be very expensive in the end. So it's a very, very bad policy. It should not even exist.
John, who are the conspirators and what's their motive?
The question is, who are the conspirators? What is their motive? I don't think, again, there are conspirators everywhere. I think the fact is that government gets in the business of controlling. The federal government, as I've researched it, is controlled by mega corporations who pour a lot of money into presidential campaigns and whatever. I had a friend, by the way, who a good journalist who went to work for one of the key people, a senator on Capitol Hill. And he was up there about 2 weeks, and we were talking. He said, John, he said, I was really, something blew my mind. He said, congressmen just disappear some days, and they have what they call their afternoon chats. And I said, what do they chat about? He said, they raise money. He said, basically, it's through the corporate entities and stuff. He said, so about 2 days a week, basically, a lot of our so-called representatives are raising money for the next campaign. In fact, as I've heard from people on the Hill, the day after a lot of these people get elected, they're trying to raise money. So, but if you go back, the original system was basically a volunteer system. It wasn't to be a paid position to be in Congress. People, remember what George Washington did? He was like Cincinnatus. He went back, became a farmer. Yeah, it wasn't a money-making venture. It was service to the country and the community. We've lost all that. So essentially what we have, and I believe this to be true, many governmental bodies have become like private corporations. They operate with a lot of money. We don't have that. We don't have that kind of power. And then they have the enforcers. A lot of the people we see from NSA, the police agencies, are basically the face of what we see up there. And to be honest with you, it's not very friendly. Yes, ma'am.
I am not aware of the kinds of training law enforcement personnel have. Is there any emphasis placed on human psychology, behavioral psychology, rather than physical skills? I mean, good thinking skills before we act.
From what I hear about training in the police academies now, I've had emails from people who have dropped out. One fellow in Colorado emailed me. He was in a police academy. He said he dropped out because the training was so aggressive, very SWAT team. I have friends who are basically very good pro-civil libertarians who are policemen. One who teaches in a police academy, he says, I'm called the anti-cop. And I said, you teach in a police academy, but you're called the anti-cop? I said, why are you called the anti-cop? He says, because I emphasize the Fourth Amendment. And I went, oh, okay. But I've offered a number of police academies to come in and help teach or send people in to help teach the Fourth Amendment and civil liberties. They're not getting a good dose of that, no. Many of the average policemen I talk to are very fuzzy on the First Amendment and fuzzy on the Fourth Amendment. They even use the wrong terms. So they're not being taught very well that. I think what I'm hearing is, again, I have a lot of good policemen I work with. The mentality has changed. I hear it especially from the older policemen. My next-door neighbor was the chief of police. And he didn't dress in black. He wore a brown outfit. He was a nice guy. He shook your hand. To give you a true story, 1 year, I was like 13 or 14, and there was this hill coming. I lived in Bartonville, Illinois, right outside of Peoria, Illinois. Cars were coming up the hill, and I was, mischievous kid. So I got three or four cartons of eggs, and I egged the cars, their windshields. They were swerving and stuff, and we were all cheering. And all of a sudden, someone grabbed me from the back of the neck, pulled me back. I looked up, and it was Scotty, the police chief. He grabs me and takes me to the police car. And I said, "Oh, you're taking me to jail?" He said, "No, I'm taking you to a worse place." And I said, "What? Your dad." He took me home. My dad took me down to the basement and whipped the crap out of me. You know something? I never egged another car. But today, it's immediate arrest and taking you downtown. So the mentality has definitely changed.
We've heard Police Chief Longo talk about the constitutional rights at your institute.
Yeah.
Is he doing that in the implementation of training for his officers? And is there anything commensurate with the Albemarle County Police so that they're informed about the civil rights?
All I basically know about what Tim Longo does, Tim, in my opinion, does the best you can do, okay, as a police. Yeah. He emphasizes rights, following the book. In fact, one of his policemen came to one of my seminars once, and he came up, and we were talking, and he said, "I work for Tim Longo." And I said, "Oh, yeah, how's he?" He said, "Buy the book." So I went, "That's the way to do it, dude." So as far as Albemarle County, I don't have much dialogue with him. Any other questions?
Not quite sure how to. I feel a little incoherent asking this, but it seems to me that we've had a steady progression in civil liberties. Even in the very early days of the late 18th century, there was the sedition laws. We've seen the House Un-American Activities Committee. Yeah. Saw the sedition laws at the end of World War I. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, at least we seem to have the laws in terms of civil liberties. So why is it that we are allowing these various authorities this power? Have things ever been better in terms of civil liberties?
Have things ever been better about civil liberties? Well, I don't know if you've read Thomas Jefferson. He was lamenting shortly after the Constitution was adopted that Americans were losing sight. I would say since the 1950s, we've gone steadily downhill. To give you kind of a chilling thing that happened, I spoke to a group of people about a little over a year ago on this issue here in this town, and a lady came up to me, an older lady, and she said she was a teenager in Nazi Germany, and I didn't know who she was, and she talked to me for a while, and she got kind of teary-eyed. She says, what we saw happen in Nazi Germany is starting to happen in the United States. That started me kind of on a train reading Nazi history, and there's two good books on it, by the way, I would really encourage you to read. One by a guy named Robert Gelately. He's a professor called Backing Hitler, Oxford University Press, and another book by a fellow named Richard Rubenstein on Nazi Germany. But how Nazi Germany worked, and we have to be cognizant of this, it was the average citizen went along with basically what was going on. They were apathetic, or they really liked the way the government operated. As early as 1933, there were articles running nationwide newspapers about the concentration camps. First, they started with the homeless people, then so-called antisocials, homosexuals, gays, and then to Jews. Everybody in those groups never thought it was going to happen to them. Until they were on the train to Auschwitz. So I think the lady that came up and talked to me is basically right. Reading history, as my wife knows, it's depressing. It's a little scary. Hitler was a very good politician. He made the right moves. He worked with religious organizations. He got everybody in sync, and he did what he wanted to do in his secret police. I don't know, and this is a really obscure thing from history, and I ferreted it out by just my study of history. Edmund Patrick Coffey was one of the chief assistants to J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI. In 1938, he went over and studied with the Nazi police, the Gestapo, and was ecstatic at how good and efficient they were. Hoover supposedly was on his way over shortly thereafter, then the wars broke out. What we saw in the 1950s, remember all that stuff in the 1950s, McCarthy and all that? It's so parallel to what we see in Nazi Germany, what I'm reading in history. So I'd say since the 1950s, we've been kind of moving downhill. But like I said, the only way it can happen is apathy. But the key to Nazi Germany, and the Nazis understood it, you got rewarded if you turned somebody in. You could actually turn somebody in for just saying the wrong thing, and the police would go do an interview with them. An interview. Remember, the veterans were helping? The FBI shows up and says they want an interview. If you don't answer the question correctly, we may take you away. We're seeing some of those signs, unfortunately.
You haven't mentioned the cause of this change, if it is a change. For example, the threat of terrorism, mm-hmm. and also the growth of a tremendous of gun freedoms and the many killings that we read about day by day. So, one, how do those affect what these events? And two, what do you think should be done about those two issues?
Yeah. Oh, terrorism, those kind of things. Yeah. Where I first became really emphatically engaged in the area was right after 9/11, when there was all, you know, the Patriot Act and stuff like that. Laws were passed allowing the government basically to do anything they want to do. I've written on that. It's covered in my book, A Government of Wolves. We can overthrow our Constitution for some terrorist acts, or we can make the government abide by it. Sure, we don't want terrorists running around, but I've been told by Secret Service agents 9/11 happened because they just didn't do their job. They didn't follow up on leads. They just didn't do it. I mean, that's a fact of history. Should, because some crazy people do things occasionally, should the FBI be able, and the NSA and all the groups be able to completely turn us into human goldfish? No. They should follow the law. I actually had, I believe it or not, a long time hitman for the CIA tell me, he said to me, "John, I'd rather see another 9/11 than us to lose our Constitution." Now, I'm not saying that. He said that. But I think we've done a wonderful job, I think, in containing terrorist acts. I mean, you're going to get people that are imbalanced are going to get through the system, sure. But Americans, by the way, are not a violent society. 2013 ended with the lowest murder rate in a century in this country. Violent crime has been dropping since the late 70s in America. Corresponding to that has been the violent rise of SWAT teams and things like that. But again, why all this happens is we're not educated, we don't listen, we're not paying attention. While we're not paying attention, the only way you can, what's the phrase Jefferson used about freedom? Eternal vigilance. What's that mean? Stay vigilant. Stay active. Get in community action. I'm not talking about voting for some politician. I'm talking about community action, getting together as a community. If you really believe in freedom, you'll grab a picket sign eventually, in my opinion.
There are people in this country and probably in this room that believe, given the way government is moving in this country, that at some time, maybe not in our lifetime, but in the near future, we will see another revolution in this country. What form it'll take, I'm not sure. But how do you see the events, the political events that are contributing to all this, fitting into the rise of a police state? And are they connected?
Oh, yeah, political events, rise of political, it's all connected, yeah, but the political events, the government wanting basically control and those kind of things, and government does, I mean, people are in power, try to keep their power, it's obvious it contributes to all this, but I'll go back again. The basic problems we see is just inactive, people inactive. I'll go as far as to say that I stopped watching television a couple years ago. You know what? I'm better informed than I ever was. I just don't sit and watch people Talking Heads debate, I read books. Wow. America, you know, by the way, and the educational system has something to do with this, rates number 11 in the world, last time I looked, in literacy rate among industrialized nations. 11th in the world? Reading, getting knowledgeable, reading history. If you don't know history, you know, we're going to repeat it. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing now. We're repeating history because we don't know history. We don't know our Constitution. So, again, education precedes action. Any of the stuff we see happening, in my opinion, can be altered. But it's up to we, the people, to do it. One more question.
We, as a nation, are increasingly, to be politically correct, tolerant of all ways of thinking and less and less remembering our history.
Yep.
And remembering our Constitution, or even respecting our Constitution. It seems to me that much of what you're saying is has to do with going back to the foundation that made this country great.
Yeah, the key is going back to the foundation, yeah, but if we don't know it, we can't act on it. And what I mean by that is I've talked to civics teachers who tell me, when I was a kid, I had a whole year of civics. By the time I hit law school, I was thinking civil liberties, ready to take it on, the system, those kind of things. I talk to civics teachers today, very good ones, and say, John, I only have a half a semester now. I'm preparing for SOLs, testing. He said, we just don't have time to do it anymore. And I give these to public schools, these Bill of Rights cards. But like I say, when I talk to law students today, they can't tell me what's in the Constitution. These are law students or lawyers. So a large problem deals with the educational system. Unfortunately, with all these zero tolerance laws, arresting kids for kicking a principal in the shin, a six-year-old, which I did, by the way, and then not teaching them their rights and teaching them if they make the simplest mistake, they're going to get banged over the head and thrown out of the school. We had one kid actually committed suicide 2 months later for getting kicked out of school. We're operating like systems of compliance. Compliant. Today, if you read the writings of Thomas Paine, if you read Thomas Jefferson, Madison, they would be considered, I mean, the British considered them terrorists, but boy, would they be radical today. Again, Martin Luther King looked like an extreme radical. And what was he asking for? Equality? That's radical in some places. So, was in Virginia. You're correct. I'm tolerant. I think we should be tolerant of all viewpoints. I'm for debate. I'm not for one particular viewpoint prevailing. But however, I think the government is there to do one thing, and that is enforce the mandates of the Constitution, and strictly so, and follow the law. If they don't, then they become a tyranny, and I think that's the direction our country's moving. Thank you very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.